Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. Also on Rabble.ca as well, who's been very kind in posting our episodes as well, our podcast audience and our growing radio audience, which Steph and I actually spent about 4 hours this week calling community stations all over the country being like, would you like free programming? So hopefully we'll have some new partners.
It wasn't, soon. Do you play our show?
No, I checked their website before I called them this time.
Excellent.
So welcome to the Green Majority here. We're live in Toronto where we're broadcasting from at the U of T campus here on CIUT. We have, I had an interview planned. Unfortunately, it had to be postponed, but I'm really excited about it. I might tease it later. Let's skip that for now. But that being said, what we're basically doing is all news all day today. I will specifically tease one specific piece of content, which was, I'm sure many people heard about, but for those that didn't, Rick Mercer posted one of Rick's rants, of course, Canadian, celebrated Canadian, and in many ways, and most of the time, like 98% of the time, celebrated progressive Canadian. And I think he thinks he was being progressive this time too, but many, many people do not agree. So we're going to get into Rick Mercer's latest rant here on Energy East and some of the feedback, and we're going to get into some of our reasons why we think that Rick Mercer might have swung and a miss on this one in a little bit. But first thing, because we have no interview, we have extra time to discuss some news, and I also have Brenna and Emma as well in the studio with us right now. And we're going to be talking about principles in a little bit. But Emmy, can you please expand?
Yeah, so it's been quite the week in terms of climate change-related discussion. There's sort of a firestorm of discussion that started last week around the pipelines issues. And it kind of culminated in an announcement on Wednesday by Natural Resources Minister Jim Carr and Environment Minister Catherine McKenna when they announced that the government is launching an interim review process that will actually impose more steps on projects such as Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain pipeline and TransCanada's Energy East pipeline before they can actually be built. So in a nutshell, process-wise, the ministry will analyze greenhouse gas emissions that would result from approving pipeline projects, and the results of that study will be presented to Cabinet, and Cabinet will then be in a position to make a final decision to approve a project. This is quite a dramatic departure from the kind of process that the previous government had in place with the controversial National Energy Board. So this has obviously sparked a huge discussion, a national discussion, if you want to call it that. That's more of a civilized way of characterizing it, I would say. And what we're going to do today to start off the show is actually talk about the five principles that the government has established as part of the interim process.
Yeah, and just the first one, just to tease it, I think to some extent sort of shoots the whole thing in the foot, at least when it comes to some of the more major pipelines. Given that the first one is no project proponent will be asked to return to the starting line, which means that anything going on right now gets to continue, which includes, you know, arguably the major pipelines with Energy East and Northern Gateway, as well as, you know, all the other sort of smaller things that exist and Line 9's already through. So as great as the next four are, how do you sort of bounce back from that first one?
So there was a slight add on that, and I don't know if it was a backing up of position or if this was just sort of details that had to be clarified. But they also did at one point clarify that they didn't mean that. Also, doesn't mean entirely hands off. That just means that there's going to be sort of like a special process for them. So I think it's not. I don't think it would be fair at this point to say that, oh, they've been given a complete pass. It's kind of one of those, you know, positions that we're frequently in, which is we have to wait and see what they mean by that.
Right.
And it's funny, some people might not agree with this, but a lot of the discussion around that particular provision was about fairness to these pipeline companies. So it's not fair just because a new interim process has been introduced that they should have to go back and do all this groundwork that they've already done, is the implication. Now, I think that there are considerable parties that disagree with this point. I don't know what you think on that, Brenna.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is I was reading a Globe and Mail article about the issue, and Tim McMillan, the president of the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, CAP, said some companies will be unhappy with the extended deadline. So Energy East got 8 more months, I believe, in Kinder Morgan's. Trans Mountain got 4 more months of review. And he said some will welcome clarity of the new process. Having the people of Canada understand more fully the robustness of the regulatory system is what this is intended to do, and that it'll provide more public support and confidence. So if you get the president of CAP saying that this is going to be reveal what a robust regulatory system this is, I don't think that's a very good sign for what we actually have on our hands, which is some really Band-Aid reforms. And I'd also note, as I was waking up this morning, came in on my Twitter that last night National Observer posted a piece about the chiefs from BC, Manitoba, and Quebec rejecting the Liberal pipeline reforms. And Grand Chief Philip Stewart noted that they hadn't even been consulted on the 5 new principles. So what does that say about what we're dealing with?
So I think that begs the question of when you're about to reform an institution that's been heavily flawed and a process that has been criticized as heavily flawed, how far back to the drawing board should you actually go? So that's a nice segue, I think, to the second principle, which is decisions will be based on science, imagine that, traditional knowledge of Indigenous peoples and other relevant evidence. Now, this is a pretty big departure from the way business has been conducted under the previous government.
Yeah. So two quick things on that. One is that, when I hear things like policy now, when a politician say something like, policy from now on will be based on science. That's like when I go into a restaurant and you're like, oh, we have a new menu. From now on, our menu is going to be based on food. You're like, what the hell? How were you doing before? That's just half joke, but so I'm sort of serious about that. And the other thing was, I was criticized recently on Twitter, which really hurt my feelings, and I was accused of being some sort of Marxist, Leninist, communist, fascist, all sorts of contradictory things, which is fine. But it made me cry a little. So in the defense of the internet, because internet comments really get to me, Stefan, by random anonymous people.
Yes, that's
I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a moment, and you guys see what you think of this. So one of the things that we were talking about for years with policy was that even business, we were talking about this for years, even business was demanding some form of climate policy because a big nature of the thing for business is predictability, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it would be a fair argument, you guys tell me what you think, to say that on that same argument, if you're going to be, let's be consistent and say that it would be too disruptive to the process, okay, it's bad, and that maybe the argument would be that we can't, if we start jerking around with, changing all the rules and everything mid-process, that this does create instability and unconfidence in the Canadian business sector, and that maybe this will stifle investment and hurt Canadians' economy even more than just not going ahead with these pipeline projects, and that, maybe we could make it up somewhere else, but that this, in a totalitarian, that wrong word, in a holistic sense, I went there demagogue for a minute, in a holistic sense that this might actually be the better solution. What do you guys think of that?
Well, that's what I find so interesting about both the CAP comments and sort of this idea of better regulatory systems is that it sort of obfuscates, if I can try to use that word correctly, the actual conversation. CAP wants this pipeline built. The people criticizing don't. What we're really debating is whether or not, ultimately, these 5 principles will be based, and people will decide if they like them or not if they get their way. That's it. There's no set of 5 principles you could have laid out that if they then built Energy East, people would be happy with them. It doesn't matter how robust these 5 principles are. We cannot afford to have Energy East built, and so we would not be happy with anything built that allowed you to get built. Perhaps you could sell it if you got Canada-wide actually useful carbon, pressing carbon, maybe. But to have both sides talking about this as if it's these are good. This could be provided useful regulatory services or get the public on side. That doesn't matter. Coming from someone who will consistently argue that progress is progress and that is good. And so this is I can also flip the coin on that. But there, at some extent, there's still the conversation of would is there anything that we could have done that would make business happy if energy use didn't get passed, or anything that would make us happy if it does?
So let's come back to the science principle then, because I think this is important, mm-hmm. right? When you're weighing competing interests, as you've characterized it, this mm-hmm. is a departure in that it's saying that the Ministry of the Environment is actually going to be doing the assessment. So the implication is that ideally that assessment is scientific based. It is rooted in the emission consequences. And that's one of the other principles, which is direct and upstream greenhouse gas emissions linked to projects under review will be assessed by this ministry. They will not be assessed by the National Energy Board. Is there potential for that to be a balancing and objective factor in this review process? We didn't see any opportunity under the previous regime. Is there cause for optimism or not?
Yes, obviously. I'd say anything is cause for optimism at this point. But again, what's our conversation, upstream or downstream? To some extent, like you can extract the oil with zero emissions. You can extract infinite oil with zero emissions, and that would have no upstream greenhouse gas emissions. As soon as we burn that, we're all frying. I fully understand the point. Yes, science based is better than not science based. But ultimately, the question is, what science?
And Catherine McKenna was quite clear that this does not, at this time, include downstream emissions when asked about that.
Yeah, and they made that clear by highlighting that it did cover upstream emissions, which was interesting. That's the Politics 101, folks, in case you missed that. Sorry, continue. Go ahead.
Yeah, so that was principle two. Principle three, the views of the public and affected communities will be sought and considered. Now, this is interesting because what do we mean by affected communities? Last time I checked, greenhouse gas emissions affected all of us. So how do we, Brenna, unpack that principle? How wide do you think it should go?
That's a tough question because, there's a lot of young people advocating for climate action right now because of future generations being affected. So, of course, that's significant. But to me, I think of the most directly affected people by pipeline projects and by emissions that come from living close to those sources. And I think it's a snub on both sides because it's not, I mean, it does single out Indigenous communities and frontline communities as being, I believe, later in the regulations. But I think it's intentionally vague to kind of escape any kind of like criticism of not listing a certain community.
I guess principles by their nature can sometimes be vague, mm-hmm. but it seems when questioned that a lot of the process, how it's been conceived, is not really clearly defined at this point. Now, maybe one can argue in fairness to this new government, they have just stepped in and at least they've recognized that the previous process was highly flawed. Do they deserve some credit for that or no?
What I was going to mention is that it is really hard to tell because, for instance, in the National Observer, it said that the government is delivering on its election campaign promises and commitments to improve consultations with Indigenous people. So is this the full delivery of that promise or are they just interim? And also just coming back from COP, seeing like the continuity or sorry, the how vague the Harper government was in answering questions and how vague the Trudeau government was in answering questions at COP, like certainly there was more consultation and more collaboration, but there was still a lot of vagueness in answering questions. And I think that the Trudeau government just doesn't quite know yet.
Okay, so I just thought of something I wanted to jump on then. I don't know if you guys know this story. Maybe actually, Stefan, if anyone knows this, I bet it's you. Do you mm-hmm. know the story of the stone soup?
I'm not sure.
Okay, really, really quickly. This is very applicable. Okay, so there's just the super brief version. You can look this up on the internet or whatever. But it's the idea of this guy that comes to town. He doesn't have any money, but he tells the locals that he has a magic stone. And he's like, so all I have to do is boil this rock and it will make a really the most delicious soup you've ever had. He's like, you know what would make it even better? Does anyone have just a single carrot? It's fine on its own. Does anyone have one carrot? Anyway, because we're on the radio and I got to speed through this, you know where this is going, right? So slowly he's like, oh, it's good already. It'll be great. But if it's even better, and basically what he does, he just scams the entire village into putting all their food into this pot. And then, oh, wow, that was good soup. That magic stone really worked. And I kind of think that's sort of what's going on a little bit.
Right. And to be fair, that's not a bad strategy. To be totally fair to the Trudeau government, you come in after 10 years of no regulation. You have to build up a regulatory process as quickly as possible. You have people as hard on you as possible because of how far behind we actually are, and you have to sort of match you have to match a tenacity while also staying in charge. And like, as Trudeau, it would be foolish of him to start making sort of exact direct statements because they don't know. They haven't been in government for 10 years. You know, there have been governments that come in and find out that the last government actually left them a $1 billion deficit, not a surplus. It takes a while to actually understand what's going on to some extent. And, you know, and as far as if there wasn't the level of urgency there is on climate change, you could very much be like, OK, great. You know, sort of the mantra I've had for a while is, like, if this was 20 years ago, we are doing really well.
Yeah,
it's not 20 years ago. And so now we're sort of like, OK, we're like, he's saying all the right things, but again, we can't have energy, you know, like as for climate reasons and not for sort of just we're spiteful reasons.
Yeah, and my last thing on this, and I'm sorry, and then I'll let you guys finish, was just the idea that, like, yeah, it's I understand, and I want to sort of reach out to people that are seeing it this way, because I understand why a lot of people are going to look at this and say, you know, especially a lot of business folks, and business folks love to sort of promote their acumen as, I mean, look at what's his face, O'Leary or whatever, mm-hmm. being like, it's this thing, right? I'm a businessman, therefore I would be the best manager for this, for the country or whatever, be a great politician. It's nonsense, but people think that that's true. But part of the idea is that, you know, the part of the thing in business and part of the thing when you're doing like negotiating, for instance, so in almost any other context or anything where it's like it's less objective, the idea is that, you know, there's all these truisms about deals where, you know, the only fair deal is one where nobody's happy. And, you know, we could go on with all sorts of sayings people say about that. But that's only true when there's not an objective fact involved. The objective fact is we have a limit, and any deal before that limit is the same, like... There's no like, okay, we'll just have a little bit of climate change so that you guys can have more money. No, like, that's not how that works. There is a hard limit and we can't go past it. And if we're agreeing to that, then all of your solutions are non-options. You know, it'd be like two people trying to come to an agreement and not like both kind of being unhappy because they both sort of like got part of what they want, but not all. It would be like, you know, coming to a fair agreement where like, okay, we can't agree on how to live together, so let's just all agree to like commit suicide. Like, that's not an option. Right. And we just have to put things in that context of like what are possible outcomes. There are a variety of them and there are a variety of ways how to get there. But what some people are proposing is just not viable. And we have to say this isn't an opinion. This isn't about environmentalists getting our way. It's about factual reality and science. And that's it.
Well, and I just jump into that before we throw it out. Part four is what the problem with these principles are, to some extent. If you can't only take upstream action and then also say it's based on science, you're ignoring a vast percentage of CO2 emissions and then saying it's based on science. You have to choose one of those two. But number four, please, Emma.
All right. Indigenous peoples will be meaningfully consulted and, where appropriate, impacts on their rights and interests will be accommodated. So I think this does merit a significant unpacking, this statement. You'll recall that Principle 2 did acknowledge the traditional knowledge of Indigenous peoples. So this is a qualified statement. It says, where appropriate.
And also the language of accommodation is such an affront and characteristic of a statement that, you know, the Harper government would have made, Stephen Giona.
Well, just the word accommodated, what does that mean? Does accommodate mean we're going to take your land and give you some other land? Is that accommodation?
We'll placate you. Here you go. We recognize that you should be accommodated in this instance, but not in others.
Well, like, accommodated could literally mean cultural genocide. Like, if accommodate means we'll give you downtown condos in downtown Toronto and kick you off your historical land, and you like, if the government gets to define accommodated, then it's not accommodation.
Accommodated is subjective in this case, yeah.
Not to get ahead of ourselves, but it's almost like, shut up and take our money. We're building our damn pipeline, right? Well, you don't get to decide on where we build our pipeline because we're paying you, so shut up.
Well, that has been some of the conversation, actually, that's been aired this week amongst political pundits. And one of the arguments is, well, why are you bringing Indigenous people into this conversation when you know that they're just going to come out against pipelines every single time? So if the exercise is to get them on board, Is this going to add anything meaningful, adding this provision? And what I found kind of despicable, but also something interesting to discuss, is a lot of the questions in media I found was, well, how is this process going to get people on board? That is coming from the starting point of assuming that that's where the direction needs to go, that it is the job of this Trudeau government to create a process where people will feel meaningfully consulted, including Indigenous peoples, with the view of getting them to lay off opposing pipelines. And so I think a tremendous amount of pressure is actually being put on this government because we're not looking at a balanced perspective. We're not looking at people saying that this should be a process that could go either way in its outcome, like you've spoken about earlier, Darren. We're looking at a lot of people, including mainstream journalists, saying that the most desirable outcome of a consultation process is for everyone to say yes.
Well, yeah, that's the concern of whenever they mention regulatory, like the idea that it's regulation and not actually consultation. Regulation has nothing to do with – regulation presumes it's being built. And it goes back to sort of the idea of importance or useful consultation. It's not useful if the outcome is already decided. And then the fifth one we've already actually covered, which was mentioned again, is the direct and upstream greenhouse gas emissions linked to the project under their view will be assessed. But again, still in the upstream, but we sort of talked about earlier.
Yeah, I think we pretty already at least Stefan and I talked ad nauseum about that. Did you guys have anything you wanted to add on point five? No?
I think you guys got it covered.
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm pretty sure I'm on the record now on radio and recorded saying I wasn't going to talk much, but there we go. Liar again. So I'm your host, Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, also on our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners all the way across the country, now also promoted as well via the rabble.ca network as well, and our very appreciated podcasters, which are now starting to get a bonus show. And I think I'm going to be able to do, we had a little bit of audio recording trouble last week, Stefan, but I'm pretty sure I know how to fix it. So
amazing.
This week should be much better. Stay tuned for that as well. But without further ado, we're going to go to our wonderful and frequently very quiet Edward, yeah. Technician, yeah. In the other room, who's the master of the show, but the very unsung hero.
Yeah.
Do you want to say a few words?
I secretly pull all the strings. I send you guys tweets. I'm like, yo, make a point on this topic. Yeah. You know, comment here.
Little known fact, Edward's nickname is actually the Puppet Master.
Yeah, yeah. That was partly from my Metallica band. anyways, so the song we're playing today is Your Daddy Don't Know by Toronto.
All right, we are back. You're listening to Green Majority Radio here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful and very appreciated community partners, off rabble.ca or directly off the podcast, which if you're doing it that way, that is the best way.
The best way.
Because you get to hear... Stefan singing at the end? Is that what we're doing today? We're doing something. It's
That'd
always
mean.
Mystery.
I feel like it should be mean to them if I made them listen to my singing voice.
Right. Okay. So if you don't listen to the podcast, Stefan will sing.
Next week.
There you go.
Suck it.
However you're listening, we appreciate you, and we're going to get right back down to actual content because I can be selling on my own time. So I don't want to spend a ton of time on this because we sort of did a bit of a dissection of something last week, and I don't know, unless you guys really enjoyed that, you know, email us or tweet us and let us know that you really enjoyed that and we'll keep doing it. But I'm sort of assuming that we don't want to sort of dominate the whole show with me sort of providing counterarguments because you can easily go watch debates on YouTube if that's what you like. So really quickly, so we're not going to play the audio from the thing because I don't really know how the permissions work and I don't think it's worth the risk. But really, Rick Mercer, so basically the story was Rick Mercer does, you know, Rick Mercer Report, very funny, generally fairly progressive, if not very progressive in his points. Kind of surprised a lot of people, I think, a few days ago by releasing a rant essentially against the mayor of Quebec. I'm getting the
mayor of Montreal.
Quebec is not
that's
a country.
In my confusion, I'm talking nonsense. All right, so if anyone's looking for a quote to make us look silly, that was the one.
Mayor of Quebec.
Yeah, excuse me. So the mayor of Montreal... For sort of making some arguments against Energy East and saying that they didn't want to go through. We're going to get into some of those details in a little minute. And MA has some sort of more specific, just sort of about the issue in general, about Energy East and about that specific sort of piece in a minute. But I wanted to just fire through. So I thought about this for about 10 minutes, maybe tops. And came up with seven reasons why I think that Rick Mercer completely got this wrong. So first of all, essentially, we'll post a link to the video again. I just didn't want to play the audio directly on the air because I wasn't sure about how the rules work for that. But basically, he had one argument. Mm-hmm. And his one argument was just what we sort of teased a minute ago, which was, hey, Montreal, this is going to make lots of money. You get some of that money, so shut up and do what you're told. And do you want to take money away from you're punishing others. You're taking money away from others by not saying yes.
It was a nationalistic argument, basically.
Yeah, well, it was a nationalistic argument, and I'm actively not in agreement with any sort of conspiracy thinking on this. Mm-hmm. I don't think that he's been influenced. I don't think anyone made him say it. I don't think anyone he's being paid to say it. Any of that, I actively don't agree with any of that. But it was, I think, admittedly, very out of character for him to be so monochromatic in his argument. Because he basically just said the same thing for 3 minutes, which was, you're getting money, what are you, an idiot? And how dare you take money away from the rest of us? So really, really fast, and I'll pause in case Stefan wants to throw something in here. Seven reasons, I'm just going to just spitball it. So if anyone wants to come back at me on any of these, you know, to tweet us, send us, make a phone call, you can call our phone line. Happy to talk about it more, but just really quickly here. So the first thing is that the payments are based on the price of oil. It's based on profit, mm-hmm. right? So it's the amount of money we have to share, and then that's balanced around. Oil price just crashed. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't mean that there would be no benefit. Fine, but you're look at all the money. That was based on a price that we don't have. So that's just it. Immediately his only argument is now very suspect. But I have six more. The climate also has a time limit, which doesn't care about economics, which is something we get into frequently, and I can get into more if it's necessary. But like, you know, Stefan said this earlier, M.A. Brenna, everybody said it already. It is also true. It's not true because we said it. It is true, and that's why we said it. But the climate doesn't care about our economics. It just doesn't. So if we're actually serious and we're saying that we believe the climate change is real, then how much money we might or might not make cannot be the deciding factor. Or you're saying that climate change is not real or not important or you don't take it seriously. Those are that you have one of those two opinions. They're mutually exclusive. It's a true dichotomy. My other thing was apparently Rick didn't get the memo, and a lot of people haven't. So this is a reminder message to Canadians that renewables has been found in many cases, both in model-based systems and through assessments of other countries' investments, generally speaking, to be better for both the GDP and jobs. So there goes the entirety of the rest of the argument. Now, this might be region-specific and different technologies do better and different. Yes, 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 yes. The details are important. But basically speaking, this whole faith-based position, and that's what it is, a faith-based position that oil is money and money is oil, and this is a balanced equation, it may be true. But it doesn't mean it's the only thing that equals money. And it doesn't mean that it's the best. And that's where the faith thing comes in. Money is the best way to run our economy. No, it just has been the way we've been running our economy. It is not the best, both logically speaking and also demonstrably speaking in the Canadian context. Number four, if oil ever spills, there goes the profit to Quebec. Because as we know, in most cases in history, most of the time, in most cases, most of the money for the cleanup is limited to the company responsible, and the public ends up paying for the majority of it. So none of that money has been factored in whatsoever. And I would like to say, and I'm making a bit of a claim here, fairly, but I would like to say that not if, but when the pipeline spills. If we look at the safety histories of any of these companies, they can go on and on and about the world's safest pipeline all they want. The fact is they spill. And they can't guarantee they won't. And the cost, if it does, is giantly high. So this is called a risk assessment. The risk assessment on pipelines is terrifying. Now, someone's going to say trains are worse. Yes, 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 yes. But that's what we're arguing against is oil, not pipelines. Pipelines is simply one of the things that we're arguing against. But we're not saying we want trains or anything silly like that. Number five. And this is a cheap shot, I'll admit. But I'm going to make it anyway. I thought conservatives hated welfare. Brad Wall, EQ payments wouldn't be needed if we had a more balanced economy, which we could be moved to from resource to manufacturing. By the way, one of the articles we read also pointed out that approximately 30 jobs are lost in manufacturing for every one that's gained in oil. Just saying. Doesn't seem very conservative of Brad Wall to be in favor of welfare. Now, I am a very big advocate of a strong social safety net. But what's better than having a strong social safety net is not needing one. Number six. Iran has just been had a whole bunch of sanctions dropped, and OPEC, in correlation with them, will continue to keep oil prices low for quite some time. In addition to that, they are also, Iran, Iraq, Egypt, all these countries, all these Middle Eastern oil-rich countries are all massively building renewable energy. Why? Because they apparently know more, see the writing on the wall better than we do. And they're using their oil wealth to build renewable because they see what's coming apparently better than some of our premiers can. And last but not least, number seven. The world economy is starting to restructure, and even if Iraq and Saudi Arabia are building massive RE, pipeline costs are costed against total lifetime usage. I'm not going to get into a big technical discussion on this, partially because I'm not prepared for it and partially because I think it would bore people. But basically, when you're doing like a business plan, you cost things, and there's things like infrastructure, and the value is there's like over amount of time, and there's amortization. Thank you. I always screw that word up. It's like synonym and cinnamon. I almost sometimes I can't do that distinction. So anyway, all these costs, I won't get into details, but basically it only the value of the pipeline is done over the life of the pipeline. So unless the government is lying about their climate goals, we will not use this pipeline for nearly half of its life at best, which means that any economic value is significantly lower than what's being expected. That's it. That's my seven. You got anything to add?
Well, I'll leave the transfer payments to MA, and just throw that to sort of tease a conversation I want to sort of continue having on the show, which is that I think this video of Rick Mercer is the new form and most dangerous form of climate denial. That this is the Ken Fenton wrote a great piece that people should read that I'll post under the show about sort of the shifting face of what we're talking about later in the show. Great.
Way to ruin it, Stevan.
Hell, there you go. But this idea of the shifting face of how environmentalism has to deal with climate change, because denial no longer looks like a snowball on the Senate floor. Denial looks like Rick Mercer saying that Energy East is needed so to keep Canada strong. And it's a very different tact and a much harder tact to sort of deal with, because really throwing a snowball on the Senate floor, you look like an idiot, and we don't have to fight that. This is insidious and much harder to deal with.
Yeah.
It actually reminds me of, you know, all of the dialogue around John A. McDonald's train, the railroad across Canada, as being like a nation building project that was like incredibly violent for marginalized people and racialized people. So it's the same thing is happening with our pipelines in Canada.
Yeah, I feel like this is ugly, ugly politics at its worst. And, you know, I think it really is important to debunk to a certain extent the rhetoric that's being thrown around these equalization payments. I am not an expert on equalization payments, but one thing I do know, it doesn't work like this. Alberta makes a whole bunch of money. We take the surplus of that money and then we give it to Quebec. That's not how equalization payments work. Equalization payments are pooled revenue from tax dollars across the country that are then made in transfer form. However, you've got to look at how these ideas, these frameworks are constructed. One could argue that the billions upon billions of dollars that has been pumped into the tar sands industry in federal subsidies are in fact a form of equalization payment. Now, I think that if we were going to invest in a province, I would not want to see all those taxpayers' dollars going into private hands, which they have. But are we going to ask for that money back from Alberta? No, that's ridiculous. So we have to look, when we look at how our federal tax dollars are being used, we have to look a lot broader and say, well, this industry, which was invested in by the federal government with the view that it would provide jobs and good livelihood security for the people of Alberta, was a grand mistake. And the people of Quebec are not asking for that money back. So this feels like very, very petty regional politics to me. And, you know, I think it's really, really interesting how convenient it is that Quebec has become a bit of a scapegoat. You'll recall that the province of BC did put in some negative submissions against the Kinder Morgan pipeline. Now, we haven't seen that kind of negative rhetoric being flung at the British Columbia government. There's a tendency, I think, to really exploit this sort of Alberta versus Quebec divide in this case, or the West versus the East divide. And I think it's a bunch of nonsense and it's not based in actual real evidence.
So yeah, like people in Alberta have given feedback through consultation and said, many of them have said no to pipelines. The same thing happened with the Energy East review in Quebec, where extensive reviews underwent over weeks and weeks and weeks, and people said no. And it's interesting, just Emma, some of what you were saying about equalization payments. Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois wrote this article, I think, Darren, you referred to it, and he said, I sometimes forget the degree to which a large part of English Canada despises Quebec. This week, that reminder was brutal. And it just harks back to to so many things in Canadian history, like one of which is the national energy strategy under Trudeau Senior, which then gave rise to Western alienation, which gave rise to Stephen Harper. So I think it's really significant that people like Rick Mercer are saying we need to be pro-pipeline in order to like avoid this kind of division.
Yeah, and I like two sort of other specific things on that. One of them is that I mean this is a story that if you went back in you know, if there was a way to sort of to do a copy and search Google for like concepts as opposed to actual keywords, then what you would find is if you took this situation, you would find this throughout history where power structure is challenged, which is the dominant political sort of party and class, so the conservatives over 8 years, and they're associated where they get a lot of their power from, which is an extremely powerful and especially in Canada influential business community, is threatened and taken down a few notches, and they start lashing out and trying to protect themselves, and the public who gets this sort of business politics mixed with or business and economics and a poor understanding of how the actual details sort out mixed in with their politics gets encouraged in some ways actively and in some ways passively to turn on each other. And we've seen, I think, very recently, you know, with Donald Trump, where people are like, wow, look at this racist, sexist, just absolutely vile human being, buffoon. What? He has 38 support among Americans? What? And I think that's this thing. I think we're experiencing that a little bit, too, where you know, I've been quite shocked by how easily it can be provoked in anyone to simply turn on each other. And I don't want to sound cheesy here. I'm the least interested in meaningless sort of, you know, go get them rah rah statements ever. That's totally not my style. But come on, people, we got to stick together on this one. Like, seriously.
Yeah, and it's I keep going back to how silly this would be if there was a different industry. Like, the oil industry has such a privileged position in Canadian discourse because of the sort of, you know, because for all the different reasons that, like, I'm just picturing if it was a different industry that basically, you know, suddenly didn't have the revenue or suddenly the price dropped so much that we couldn't afford it. You know, like well, look what happened to sort of the car industry to some extent in Ontario. Suddenly there wasn't a market for as many cars and sell or for the manufacturing. And there was never this conversation about, hey, Alberta, why aren't you buying more cars to support Ontario? You get money from us.
Yeah.
Like it's a specific. It's so specific, I think, to the oil industry to have this sort of feeling of inevitability. And I think that's really what it is. It's that we've been. If there's one thing that environments have been fighting against for the last 20 years in these pipelines battles, it's this idea that oil is king and that all in oil infrastructure will eventually work. So just stop being annoying and get out of the way.
All right. And thank you, Stephen. I think that's a really good place. We're going to take our second and final break here. But we come back, we have a little bit of a wrap up on this because one of the things that, you know, we wanted to address as well was that people are saying, you know, the common argument was, you know, so what? You just want to abandon the people of Alberta? Or so what? So what's your alternative when you sort of say the types of things we've been saying? We have an answer for that. And also some international news roundup. We'll be back to that here on the Green Majority at CIUT, our wonderful partner stations, Rabble, and our own podcast in just a minute after Edward. What are you going to listen to this time, buddy?
Well, this time we're going to listen to It Could Happen to You by Blue Rodeo.
All right, and we're back. We're in the final section here, the home stretch here on the Green Majority radio program and podcast, CIUT Today Live, as well as our wonderful partners, Rabble, all our community radio partners across the country, our podcast audience, and people who are just randomly flipping around the dial being like, what are these jokers talking about? So we're down here in the final section. I'm once again going to throw back to one of my co-hosts here, Emma, who has prepared a couple thoughts on the final bit. We maybe have time for a quick point form list from me, but Emma, the floor is yours.
All right. So one thing that we wanted to discuss is, given this firestorm of discussion in Canada around the future of the oil and gas industry and its impact on Canadian jobs, what I want to put out for discussion is, you know, are we really seeing an industry that's in its death throes, so to speak? And, you know, a lot of people who've worked on environmental and climate issues is that this is our big moment to actually transition to the kind of economy that's not so entirely extractive based, that, you know, invests in renewable energy, etc. But the question is this really the moment, or are we at a real risk of this being blocked? Because we've seen a lot of negative commentary around around the lack of support of the new government for a resource-based economy. And of course, last week we talked about Justin Trudeau's comments at Davos about Canadians being known not for our resources, but our resourcefulness. And that sparked a huge debate and criticism. So I'm just going to put it out there and say, is this really the moment where the industry is going down, or is it waging a significant battle that we need to be aware of?
I would just say that I think we're looking at – it's ultimately not up to us. As much as I think we can force it in the direction we want to go, it's up to OPEC. If prices stay at $20, $30 a barrel, what else can we do to some extent? It's Canada's economy, at least, will be controlled by the price of oil. If it stays below a price that you cannot make the tar sands valuable, our hands will be forced regardless of what we do. You cannot build enough pipelines to make tar sands oil profitable at $20 to $30 a barrel an hour. You can't. Worldwide, a whole different question.
So that's the economic reality. But I think I would argue, Stefan, that transition just isn't about the current economic reality and the market price of oil. It's about whether a society is ready to make those kind of investments and those moves towards different kind of solutions than we've had in the past. And I guess what I'm driving at is, you know, we've talked about this concept of social license around the Energy East pipeline and how it couldn't go forward because that social license hasn't been secured. But let's unpack that concept. Is there a social license in Canada to move away from a resource-based economy?
I don't think there is yet. And when if we're talking about Canada, we're talking about sort of the aggregate population. I think across the aggregate population, there still is a sort of very subtle, subconscious almost, association. And I think understandably, because based on our history, understandable subconscious association between carbon-based fuels and the meat and potatoes of our livelihoods. The error there is that it's the best way to do it and that it's the best way for right now, or that it's the best way generally. And the error is it anymore, even if it once was? So that, like, there's reasons why that argument is wrong, but there is a very strong reason why that's not how people think about it. And I think at least at this point, unless we approach this segment of the quote unquote campaign to transition to a new economy that respects, you know, survival of life on this planet, we have to sort of see this as a hearts and minds battle now, as opposed to a political fight. And I think they're fought in different ways. And I think we have to understand that difference to be able to sort of proceed from this point.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, just in Cam Fenton's article that we've referenced, he talks about a Guardian headline from December: "The Paris Agreement signals that deniers have lost the climate wars." But I think there's a gap between, like, okay, I don't deny that climate change is real and that it's human caused, and actually supporting projects that move us away from a fossil-free economy. I just, MA had said, you know, are we winning? Is hopeful environment right now? And I just watched the documentary Fractured Land. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's easy to get kind of like caught up in the climate movement, and then you remember that thousands of pages of like meaningless, basically rubber stamp consultation are being sent to indigenous communities for liquid natural gas. So that's the other thing is it's not, I guess, just like the big pipelines that we're talking about, but there's so much infrastructure being created right now that's not going to be relevant in a matter of years.
Well, and that's just to sort of try to answer the full-on question of a resource extraction economy. That is so much more than even just fossil fuels. You know, Canada is a country of mines, of lumber, of all these other. I think those are even. You know, we could be a low carbon extractive economy to some extent, which is so that sort of highlights the difference between sustainability and low carbon. So maybe we might get off fossil fuels. I think it ends up becoming a conversation again of people. The real question is, can you get people to have a low consumptive lifestyle? That's to me the question.
Well, I want to interject the title of an article that's just been published by Bill McKibben, and it's called "The Dawn of the Climate-Killing Megaproject. When one goes down, another rises. How do we keep our planet habitable?" And I think this speaks to the threads of discussion that we've had today, that even though we're seeing a decline in the industry, these projects keep rising up. This also pulls on a line of thinking in Cam Fenton's article, which is that we can't just look at strategies that are about blocking one one pipeline at a time. We're not going to win if we take that approach. We need to look at more systems-based approaches. This is me talking. I'm not quoting Cam here. We need to take a more systems-based approach and a solutions-focused approach. And I think, Darren, you had a few thoughts on that.
I do, and I realize we're tight on time, so I'm going to skim through it. If anyone, maybe we can come back to some of this stuff later, and I'm pretty sure that I'm going to surprise you guys with at least one of these ideas, but here I go. So the least surprising thing ever, renewable energy, but people are like, well, it's not ready. Like, well, to the extent that it is, we haven't implemented it nearly as much as it is ready. I think where there's probably a lot of general misunderstanding about how ready it is. And as I said, it is better for the economy. We know this, and it's better for job creation. It's better for number stuff. Anyway, so that we could have a whole show on that, and we will again. But for now, let's leave that point. Here's another one that's interesting, and it's sort of not an economic driver, but it's something I think would be really useful, which is material standards, grouping together with some countries, kind of like the way we talked at COP, but talking about sort of really basic. So people are like, oh, don't pick the winners. It's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is in the same way that we have automotive standards for the cars, and every 10 or 15 years, the car companies go, no, you can't do that. This will kill our whatever. And then it happens, and then they adjust, and then life goes on, and they still make money. I think we could be doing that on a much wider scale. And here's the partner with that is Canada needs to go about face on what the policy. The last 10 years was about crushing science. I think we need to be we have a really good country. We have a lot of resources. We're incredibly gifted and have so many advantages. It's like the Canada privilege, you know, the extension of white privilege, where we have no idea just how lucky we are with how much stuff. If we were actually dumping that into science and research, and like that's where the real money is like patents and developing new technologies, like not just burning old stuff in the ground. Like we can do this. We can capitalize on a knowledge economy, and we can work internationally to increase the value of those things by working with other countries to make it so that the types of things we're developing are actually required. Everybody wins. We actually really win if we're the people producing this stuff. It's an option. Massive grow your own food program, because here's something that almost never gets talked about. Another way to make Canada richer. So costing sheets are two sides. There's money in and money out. And we only ever talk about money in. Nobody ever wants to talk about money out. If we reduced the amount of costs that the general Canadians have to pay to live, that's identical to giving them more money. Giant food growing program. Canada-wide, federally supported. It pays for itself, and everybody gets richer. I'll come back to that if necessary. If anybody wants to challenge me on that one, I would be happy to go on with them about that one. Now, here's the one that's probably going to surprise you. Trudeau has talked about legalizing pot. Another fun fact about pot, and I've actually been meaning to do this feature, but I've never found the right person, because I really didn't want to get into the sort of the recreational use or even the medicinal angle of this. Hemp itself as a material is one of the most useful products on the face of the freaking planet. So when we're busy, medical use, okay, fine. Completely side discussion. Paper, textiles, building materials, so much stuff can be made out of hemp, and it's incredibly environmentally friendly relative to other stuff. Yes, it gets into more complicated, but just generally... and one of the reasons why people are like, well, when I go to the store and I bought a hemp shirt from some local head shop, the reason it's expensive is because it's their tiny operations. If we do this on a massive scale, like the scale that we're doing wheat, there is enough demand for those materials. That could be our new economy on its own. I think we should pair it with all this stuff. We're going to be just fine. I got one more for you. Full cost accounting of cars is much higher than gas and insurance. There's road maintenance and blah, blah, blah. Like, think about how often we do construction. So if we had one of the things that's not talked about, if we're like really talking about a massive transit plan, Canada-wide massive transit plan, it actually, in many ways, could very easily pay for itself in the reduction of cost. When you actually do that full cost accounting, and especially when you get the economy of scale of doing it on a big scale. And here's the last thing, and I don't have a driver's license, so yes, I made this for me. Anyone who doesn't have a driver's license should be getting a giant incentive. There you go. Done.
I'm just going to jump in to the conversation. I think that you, actually one of yours referenced, and I think this is actually a funny way to frame it, is Trudeau's statement, resources versus resourcefulness. Because ultimately that's the question. That's, I think, where society is going to fight back. Society isn't going to fight back about where we get the money. I think, you know, if you could you could provide, if everyone drives a Tesla and everyone gets exactly what they're getting right now, all the same sort of stuff, but just slightly better, or in a non-resourced extractive economy, that's not the pushback. The pushback is going to be where we tell people that, no, you don't get to buy everything all the time. That's the part of society we're going to get the fight back. And as I'm going to tease this and not get into it, but what the owner of IKEA says is fascinating. the owner of IKEA has decided that we've reached peak stuff. And so IKEA is shifting its business model because he honestly thinks that we've reached peak stuff. And if for all our sakes, I hope he's right.
All right, so we've only got about 5 minutes left, and I know there was one thing I wanted to get to, but I can actually sum it up in a single line, which is that I'm going to post a video. So there was a really excellent coverage on the Flint water crisis. If you don't know anything about it, please go to the website and just watch the Young Turks. Like, they did a very comprehensive. It's extremely corruption based, and it's extremely despicable, and is some of the worst sort of racism / classism. The most obvious example of rich people just being, screw you, we're going to take money, and I don't care if your kids get cancer. It's that bad you've ever seen. So we don't have time for it on today's show. We might come back to it another week. I wanted to at least acknowledge it, first of all, because it's devastating. And second of all, because we do have a part of our audience that's American. I just wanted to be like, hey, we didn't forget about you guys. We saw that. Don't have time for it today. Please go to the website today. It will be with the show post. Watch the video that the Young Turks did. It is excellent and very fact-based. And if we can, we'll come back to it another time. But that's all. I'll leave that there for this week.
Yeah, and we do want to acknowledge that we have some great American listeners on the other side of the border, and there was actually a really good news story that came out of the U.S., and it was about the Supreme Court upholding a decision, and I'm just going to read this. Under the rule, grid operators are required to pay demand response participants the same rates for reducing energy use as those paid to power suppliers for producing energies from coal resources like coal, natural gas, wind, and solar power. So I think that kind of talks to what Stefan had mentioned around rewarding positive consumption behaviors. This is actually a landmark, I think, affirmation that's coming out of the U.S. So we need to acknowledge these positive stories as well.
That's fascinating. Just the second that we start acting like not using is as good, like not using is as good as producing more, is a step in the right direction. I think that's where, again, Emma and I have been going back about this plan to win conversation that eventually we will have, we promise.
We'll do it as soon as we get to do. I want to do an entire show, and I could do an entire show alone. I won't dominate it, but I could do an entire show alone on other things we could be doing. I get like 5 ideas a day. Not all of them are good, but I could get it down to like 20 over the last like 8 years of things we could be better doing with our time.
I want to hear 20 more ridiculous ideas.
That'll be a second show.
Okay, great. But yeah, like it's just this. There's just this piece that I think we've sort of thrown through this entire show of this conversation about, you know, when we're talking about energy use, so what's the actual conversation we're having? Or when we're talking about sort of this internal fighting of the future of Canada. It's the ultimate battle that's being waged here isn't about energy east, isn't Quebec versus the West, isn't about the West versus Ontario or Ottawa or anything like that. The entire battle we're waging here is, do I get to have all the stuff when I want it, or don't I? And alternatively, like, what does that stuff look like? And I think in Cam Fenton's article as well as Bill McKibben's, there's sort of this hint at, okay, climate change people, we've won the denial argument, basically. You know, every single, you know, there's still denialists and of course, and there's a different type of denial that we're now facing. But what are we doing? It was like, we spent the last 20 years yelling, hey, everyone listen to us. And now we finally got the room quieted down enough. They actually could hear us speak. And now we're standing there silent. And the question is, what do we say now?
I will never be silent, Stefan. You know that. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for listening to the Green Majority Radio program. Unless, of course, you are listening on our podcast, and then we'll be back in just a couple minutes. We have Sabina, one of our new volunteers as well, who's going to be joining us for the brief after show. Maybe we'll get a little bit more into some of these ideas. Maybe we'll complain a bit more about Rick Mercer. Who knows? You'll have to find the podcast to find out as well. And we have a number of really interesting guests coming in. We actually found a bunch of people who are going to be coming in and doing some. We're experimenting with a new format. We're going to have some people coming in and doing some interesting kind of reports instead of our usual interview feature coming up soon. So lots of cool things. Check the website to learn more, greenmajority.ca. Other than that, have a good green week, folks. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see y'all real soon.